Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Broadcast at 90.1 FM and webcast live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here do not necessarily represent the views of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber. He believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And this hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.centraliljwj.org. That's centraliljwj.org.
Okay, thank you, Bob. We're going to be having Dr. Margaret Flowers call in at half past the hour from Baltimore. She's a physician, and she's very much, of course, involved in the single-payer Medicare for All campaign, but she's also involved with stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership and net neutrality. She was just recently arrested at the Federal Communications Commission hearings in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago. It's funny, I was watching the news, and all of a sudden this woman stands up and starts speaking out in front of the chairman, and next security comes and starts dragging her out. Like, oh my God, that's Margaret Flowers.
We've had her on the show before. She's indeed very knowledgeable.
Yes, yes, and very, very active. I really admire her for all her activism and stuff. So Bob, as far as news stories, what do you have for us today?
Well, I got a couple updates we'll start with here. The refinery strike continues, although next week negotiations are moving to Houston. Negotiations for the labor strike affecting 15 oil refining facilities in seven states are moving to Texas on Monday. Some 7,000 members of the United Steelworkers are on strike at refineries and other facilities owned by six companies. Shell Oil is handling the negotiations on behalf of the affected refining companies. Both Shell and union leaders held a teleconference meeting this Wednesday. Union leaders said that the two sides discussed at length concerns regarding safety. Among their demands were manageable overtime hours and adequate staffing levels to ensure safe conditions for members, facility operations, and the surrounding communities. And union leaders indicated that they also discussed facility maintenance concerns and the assignment of daily maintenance work to the bargaining unit. In a related story to this, I came across something that talks about neighborhood groups in Martinez, California, have called out Tesoro Corporations. They're one of the six companies involved in the strike, and they've got like three refineries. Tesoro has decided to block access to company-owned ballpark to area children's baseball teams.
Oh.
The San Francisco Chronicle reported late Monday they called it mean-spirited. Says San Antonio-based Tesoro is barring the Junior Optimist Baseball League, along with its 49 teams and more than 600 boys and girls, from using company-owned baseball fields while the strike continues. Tesoro normally leases its fields to the communities for $1 per season, but the company has since blocked access to the fields as a safety precaution to protect children, parents, and coaches during the plant strike.
Oh, please. Yeah. You know what those kids need to do? They need to just go out there and start playing baseball and get arrested. I saw, speaking of Wisconsin, I think you got a news story on Wisconsin coming,
yes, coming up.
Don't mean to beat you to the punch, there was, I guess, Scott Walker made a gubernatorial decree or whatever, saying that there's no not going to be any more sledding on the hill on the where the Capitol building is.
So
the very next day, right after a snowfall, I guess these hundreds of kids came and just started sledding anyway, and the Capitol Police refused to arrest them. So,
oh, good.
You know, and it's good. Funny because these kids, I mean, they've got more spunk than a lot of these labor leaders, unfortunately. I mean, that's a form of direct action, and it, you know, it gets the goods usually. And I think that's what these kids need to do with those baseball diamonds. Let the company be responsible for arresting a bunch of kids for playing baseball. I mean, can you imagine what the press would be? I mean, even the corporate media would pick up on something like that.
Corporate media already called it mean-spirited, but 600 kids, you know.
Yeah,
losing their baseball fields here.
Well, they need to take it back. Okay, I guess I got a new story here. I was going to mention this last week, but we got so involved in our program, our spirited program last week, I kind of ran out of time. But I guess 2 weeks ago in Springfield, there was on the health committee, which our local state representative Carol Ammons is a member of now, there was an introduction of the single-payer Medicare for All bill for Illinois. There were six people that came in person to testify in support, and there was 102 online witness slips in support of the bill. And anyway, it's interesting because what happened was that, you know, it was introduced, it's in committee, and another, group that was unexpected that came you know, basically, testified in support of it, was a public citizen of Illinois, which was quite a surprise, I guess. But what was equally interesting was the people, or I should say entities, that came to oppose it. And I mean, you're talking about a little subcommittee hearing with six people testifying. No big threat, you'd think, but Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois showed up. The Illinois Hospital Association and the Illinois chapter of the National Pharmaceutical Association came out, took their time to come out and basically testify against this proposal, you know. So, just that alone, just talking about it is a threat to these corporate special interest, you know. So anyway, at this point, the bill's not going to be taken out of committee at this point. And mainly, this is more or less a education and public awareness tactic, if you will. But the bill's going to they're going to keep introducing the bill every time it comes up for renewal, and use that opportunity to talk about the single payer Medicare for All.
Yeah, interesting. So getting back to Wisconsin there, and on Friday, it says here, Weary, Wisconsin lawmakers on Friday approved a bill that stops private sector workers from being required to join a union or pay dues as a condition of employment, and sent it to Republican Governor Scott Walker, who's expected to sign it on Monday. So the Republican-led state assembly voted 62-35 on party lines to make Wisconsin the 25th right-to-work state. The final vote came after 24 hours of debate in the assembly and 2 weeks after State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald announced plans to take up a right-to-work bill. It says here, supporters cast the measure as an incentive for attracting businesses and jobs, saying it is wrong to force workers to pay dues if they don't want to.
Uh-huh.
I've come across some statistics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Walker has been promoting jobs in Wisconsin ever since before he got elected, you know. Said he was going to do 250,000 new jobs in his first term and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that Wisconsin is behind every one of its neighboring states except for Illinois as far as job creation since Walker's gotten elected. So he hasn't done a really good job of getting any of these jobs that he's promised people.
And you wonder about what kind of jobs those are. I mean, you know, the ones that are created, are they just, you know, minimum wage, no benefit, you know, jobs?
Right.
And that's always when they say create jobs. Well, what kind of jobs? You know,
right.
So he can't even do that, you know, it seems.
So Republican Representative Dean Knutson says, we stand today for a simple but very powerful concept, the concept of worker freedom. And opponents called it a thinly disguised assault on organized labor that will drive down wages and leave workers vulnerable. And a Democratic Representative Andy Jorgensen said, this has nothing to do with freedom. It has nothing to do with choice. It has everything to do with busting.
Oh, for sure. For so. Sure. Well, it's interesting that we didn't even, consult on this, but, I've got a related story to that.
All right.
This is from the Grand Prairie Union News, which is out of Bloomington, Illinois. It's a monthly, paper. And, anyway, it's, the title of this article is, What is a Right to Work Law? And, it basically says, with Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner advocating local right to work laws, it's important to ask, what is a right to work law? And what does it mean for workers? In states where the law exists, right to work makes it illegal for workers and employers to negotiate a contract requiring everyone who benefits from a union contract to pay their fair share of the costs. Right to work has nothing to do with people being forced to be union members. In other words, if you decide you're like, say, it's usually the public sector unions. If you decide you don't want to be part of the union and not pay union dues, they still require you to pay half union dues because, you know, whether you're in the union or not, you benefit from the contract that's negotiated as far as the wages and benefits. And also, if you got a problem with your boss, you still get representation from the union rep. So, I mean, this is the whole thing is that, you're getting services, but you're not paying your, full share, which, I mean, in this case, with the right to work laws, they won't be required to pay anything. But anyway, federal law already guarantees that no one can be forced to be a member of a union or pay any amount of dues or fees to a political or social cause they don't support. What right to work laws do is allow some workers to receive a free ride, getting the advantage of a union contract without paying any fee for contract negotiations or on the job representation. That's because the union must represent all workers the same regardless of whether they join the union or pay its dues or other fees. A union contract must cover all workers, again, regardless of their membership in or financial support for the union. In states without right-to-work laws, workers covered by union contract can refuse union membership and pay a fee covering only the costs of workplace bargaining rather than the full cost of dues. And there's scant evidence these laws, these right-to-work laws create jobs, help workers, or are good for a state's economy. As supporters of a claim, instead, these laws weaken unions and thereby hurt workers, the middle class, and local economies. And that's workers, even if you're not in a union, if union wage rates are pushed down, non-union wage rate wages are going to be pushed down as well. There's a direct correlation. The higher the union wages are in a particular state or country, the higher non-union wages are. It's just a matter of, sort of a supply and demand thing that employers have got to try to keep up, you know, at least somewhat with union wages, not match them, but at least be within, 20% of them, or they'll lose workers,
Right. I got a couple of statistics to go along exactly what we're talking about here. First, starting again with Wisconsin, it says about 8% of private sector workers in Wisconsin are union members. That's down from about 22% 3 decades ago. Moving on to some national statistics, in 2014, union membership rate was at its lowest in ever, I believe. Last year it was 11.1% on a national basis.
Wow.
Down 0.2 percentage points from 2013. Says here, public sector workers had a union membership rate of 35.7%. That's more than 5 times higher than private sector workers, which is only 6.6%. And here, getting into what you're talking about, driving down wages, median weekly earnings of non-union workers were $763 a week. That's only 79% of earnings for workers who were union members, which is $970 a week. So 79% for non-union workers compared to what the union workers make.
Okay. All right.
80%, a little bit less than that. So, so, you know, it brings
up. So I just pulled that out of the air, basically, that 20% figure. I was pretty close, evidently.
So this brings up something here that I wonder about, is like, if there's only 8% of private sector workers that are in unions, why are these people trying so hard to bust these unions? Why do they constantly make these statements saying, the all-powerful unions, they control everything. We can't fight the unions. They got so much money, this and that. And it's all a bunch of hoo-ha, really.
Well, it's all about power. I mean, that's the thing is they want to remove any obstacle that slows them down or prevent them from doing their full agenda, which is basically to push everybody down to subsistence levels, to poverty levels, to where we're all fighting for a $2 an hour job. That's what they want. That's their goal. And to basically disempower working people to where they have no organizations to represent them or fight back and defend themselves. That's what the whole agenda is. It's not about economics, really, in general. It's more about power relationships.
Moving on, we got Gus's story of the week here.
Okay.
Once again, out of Wisconsin. And this is the matter.
What's the matter with that book came out 10 years ago by, I can't remember his name now, but what's the matter with Kansas now? Right. What's the matter with Wisconsin here?
Well, I don't know. Madison police chief calls for restraint after officer kills black teen. This just happened last night.
In Madison, no way.
Madison, Wisconsin police chief Mike Koval says it is absolutely appropriate for protesters to express their feelings after a police officer shot an African-American teenager Friday night, but he called for restraint and said an outside agency will investigate the fatal shooting. Koval said the incident occurred after an officer called to investigate a man jumping into traffic, followed a teenager, to a nearby apartment and forced his way in after apparently hearing a disturbance. According to the mayor, Koval told reporters that the teenager then assaulted my officer, and in the context of mutual combat, the officer did draw his revolver and subsequently shot the subject. He said more than one shot was fired. So a large crowd gathered at the scene, some carrying signs and shouting Black Lives Matter. They dispersed in the early morning hours. It says that no weapons were found around the teen. So it's another one of these instances, you know. The mother says, my son has never been a violent person, and to die in such a violent, violent way, it baffles me.
Yeah. This is just getting out of control. And, you know, Bob, as we were talking off air, what's happening here, this is not just, and I was wondering about this a while back, but I've done some research and talked to some other people I know that have done a lot of research, like Gus, for instance. And he said that it's not just the awareness of these things, it's that they've actually, the number of these police killings of unarmed people has increased exponentially. And the consensus is this is because of the way the police are being trained these days. They're being trained instead of serving and protecting the community. They're being trained as they're a military occupation force in an occupied country, right, and that the population is the enemy. That's right. The problem.
Right.
In a nutshell. I mean, there's other issues too, like racism and that sort of thing, but, you know, in general, the police are, I mean, and this is coming from the highest levels, from the federal government on down. This is, I think, part of the whole thing is that they know if they keep pursuing their neoliberal agenda that people are going to start fighting back. So they want the police to be more aggressive so that it intimidates people and frightens people from even going out to a peaceful protest, much less, standing up for your rights, you know, when you're being confronted by a police officer. Who's in the wrong?
The mayor said the initial findings did not reflect a gun or anything of that nature had been used by the subject, by the teenager. So, ironic we have to have these discussions 50 years to the date after the Selma Bridge March, you know.
Indeed.
The Edmund Pettus Bridge.
And what day was that? Was on Monday or last Sunday?
Today is the 50th anniversary.
Today is the 50th anniversary
of that particular march. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And you see old TV newsreel footage of that, and it was brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I read a story about a little town about 50 miles north of Selma, where actually the Supreme Court has just struck down some of these voting laws and stuff like that last year and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying this has just gone back to, you know, where it was 50 years ago.
Wow.
You know, they redistricted to make the district more white, and mm-hmm. they removed the one black congressperson that they had, or city council person in the city and stuff like that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's going back to just a similar way as to what it was, you know, 50 years ago. So,
yeah.
In some respects, a lot of progress. In other respects, no progress whatsoever.
And actually some de-evolution on a lot of the progress that was made, yes. You know? Okay, some quick public service announcement before our guest calls in at half past the hour. Rich Whitney, the Illinois Green Party chair, will be speaking to the Prairie Greens and others concerned with the proposed state budget next Saturday, a week from today, March 14th, from 1 to 2:30 p.m. at the Champaign Public Library, Room C. A special Central Illinois Prairie Green chapter of the Illinois Green Party event and press conference. We could actually address the problem of Illinois' horribly backward system of taxation. Come here to Rich Whitney, past candidate for Illinois governor, explain that solution and how to solve the budget and pension crisis with one simple step. And for more information, you can contact contact me at 721-217-721-0583 or email prairiegreensil@gmail.com. And stay tuned after the labor hour. Playing of Union Edge is going to be preempted by Rich Whitney's speech from 3 weeks ago at the Champaign Library.
Oh, okay. Great.
And the also let you know that today, from 2 to 4 p.m., the wars continue in the Middle East. There's the potential for entering into more wars in the Ukraine and other places in the world unless people stand up and peacefully protest. And this is anti-war and racism efforts, monthly demonstration from 2 to 4 in downtown Champaign at the corner of Neal and Church Street. And if you want to, there's going to be a little get-together before the 2 o'clock demo at the Esquire Lounge starting at 1 p.m. So do that, and also let you know this Sunday and every Sunday is Labor's Worldview TV, and this Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 or UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. You can see the history and current activities of the IWW. This is an episode from 2009. It was episode number 2 in Labor's Worldview TV's archive. So, yeah, tune in for that. Very interesting documentary, both of yesteryear and more recent activities today. We're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
There once was a rocker girl with the freak flag to unfurl and a puppet show on the WTO with a message that intended to change the world. She'd go to the center of town where her comrades were locked down, and she never was afraid when the pepper spray sprayed. She always stood her ground. She'd sing, "You can't catch me, I'm running with the black block. Stuff your crotch with a tube sock, copper, I'm running with the black block. No, you can't catch me, I'm running with the black block. And I'll be running with the black block till the revolution is nigh, till the day I die."
One, two, three, boycott, boycott. Could be the strongest tool we got. Boycott, boycott. Could be the strongest tool we got. Boycott, boycott. Could be the strongest tool we got. Nobody gonna spend their money here. Hit the street, I'm telling everyone we meet. Hit the street, I'm telling everyone we meet. Hit the street, I'm telling everyone we meet. Solidarity's strong round here. Rank and file, we're gonna go that extra mile. Rank and file, we're gonna go that extra mile. Rank and file, we're gonna go that extra mile. We got a good strong voice right here. Wildcat, wildcat, that's how we show 'em where it's at. Wildcat, wildcat, that's how we show 'em where it's at. Wildcat, wildcat, that's how we show 'em where it's at. There'll be no business as usual here.
You want Walmart to stop union busting? All you got to do is call Sam Walton on the phone and he'll do that for you. Yes, he'd do that for you, my friend, sure as old red, white, and blue. 'Cause you know Sam, he's the people's man, and he'll raise your wages too. Oh, put it on the ground, spread it all around, dig it with a hoe, it'll make your flowers grow.
Oh.
Hi. Hi, can you hear us now?
Now I can hear you.
Wonderful, wonderful. Sorry about that. We have a little technical problem here, but I guess we got it corrected. So how you been doing, Margaret?
I'm doing well. Hold on, I'm going to plug in my earphone. Hold on 1 second.
Okay.
Okay. Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, indeed. Okay. Thanks for your patience. Stick it in there.
Sure.
So, okay. I guess, it seems like, you've been a pretty busy person, recently. I happened to be watching the television news a couple weeks ago, and I thought I saw you being escorted out of the, net neutrality FCC hearings.
That's true. Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were going to mention that one or the TPP hearing.
Okay. Okay. I didn't catch the TPP hearing, but, yeah, both really important issues and stuff. And,
right.
Of course, you're still involved with the, you know, the single payer Medicare for all issue and stuff. And,
that's right.
So I want to talk about all these here because they're all very important. And, maybe, maybe we could start with, you know, the single payer activities and stuff. Maybe you could just give us a little update what's going on in Baltimore and Maryland and maybe other parts of the country you're aware of.
Sure. Well, I mean, efforts still continue to move forward at the state level, as well as at the national level. You know that John Conyers introduced recently H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, and people are working in their communities to get their members of Congress to co-sponsor that legislation. I think last time I looked, it was 50-something. It may be more than that now that are co-sponsoring.
Mm-hmm.
At the state level, people are moving forward with single-payer legislation, with building their, you know, healthcare as a human right type of framework movements. In Maryland, we decided after a number of years of trying to push our legislators to support our single-payer legislation that what we really needed to do is build political muscle like they did in Vermont. So our healthcare as a human right campaign for the past several years has just been focused on building local groups that are meeting regularly and doing outreach. And so that's been really successful.
Mm-hmm.
We have a number of active chapters. And this year, for the first time in a while, we did hold a lobby day.
Oh, okay.
So that was interesting, bringing our new members who have never done that before, training them on how to talk to legislators and then going in and meeting with a lot of new legislators that were, okay, you know, really not familiar with this. So that was great.
Okay. And have you heard any more news from Vermont after the little betrayal, a little political shenanigans up there?
Yeah. So for your listeners who aren't familiar, you know, the healthcare is a human right movement in Vermont was really successful in getting a governor elected who supported a single-payer platform and putting forward a universal publicly financed healthcare legislation. It's not a technical single payer, but it's better than what other states have. And then in December, after the governor was reelected, he had been required to put forth a financing plan and had been stalling on that, and he finally put one out. Well, basically he said, you know, this is too expensive, we can't do it, which really wasn't accurate because mm-hmm. we know that our current system is so expensive and that a publicly financed system has health savings that are cost savings that you can't otherwise get in a fully privatized, you know, fragmented system. So the people in Vermont have put together their own proposal for financing, and they've gotten over 100 economists to back that proposal. They've been pushing their legislators to hold a public hearing on this. That hasn't happened yet, but they're going to go ahead and move forward without the governor to try to get a very progressive financing proposal put forth in the legislature. So we'll see how they do with that.
Okay. Well, here in Illinois, we submitted a single payer Medicare for all bill about 2-3 weeks ago. And only six people went to testify at the subcommittee hearing. But it was, and about 102 people did online witness slips. What was really interesting was of who came to oppose it. I mean, here just little bitty subcommittee and only six people, you know, and it was, but we had Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, some National Pharmaceutical Association, as well as the Illinois Hospital Association, all show up to, you know, speak out against the bill and stuff. And it was really amazing how just talking about single-payer Medicare for all frightens these corporate special interests in the healthcare industry.
It's really amazing. And I bet I've been in similar types of hearings in other states. I imagine that it was similar in yours, that when you have the people that are testifying for, you know, a universal publicly financed plan, they put forth a lot of facts.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, it's really based on what's best for the people. And then you listen to these lobbyists testify, and it's just like you wonder, how can they really live with themselves, the things that they're saying?
Yes, indeed.
It's so shallow.
Yes, and our recently elected state rep, just by coincidence, got appointed to this healthcare committee, and she voted, of course, in favor. It passed the committee, but they're not gonna put it on the floor yet because we don't have the votes yet. We don't have enough pressure on all the politicians to pass it.
Right.
But what was interesting was that when she ran in the primary elections here as a Democrat, that the state Illinois state party spent an unprecedented amount of money and conducted a real slanderous smear campaign against her to try to prevent her from being elected. I think that might be one of the reasons why. Because, you know, when a corporate special interests, which, of course, we know the Democrat and Republican parties are, you know, pretty controlled by, when they see somebody that's actually going to be the real thing as opposed to the usual political phony, they feel really threatened. And but anyway, so just to get back, one other thing too, our state rep has set up a series of constituent committees, one of which is healthcare. She basically wants to know what our her constituents want, and she wants then, of course, us to do the research to help her be more effective. So we're real locally, we're really pleased. It's just that, you know, at the state and national level, that's the real frustration, it seems. But anyway, so with now moving on to the net neutrality, it seems like we've had there's been a victory there. Could you talk a little bit about this as far as the whole battle with the FCC and corporate special interests there?
Sure, and that's a great segue because, you know, what you're talking about is, you know, corporate interests trying to defend their bottom line against the rights and needs of the people. And it was very similar in the net neutrality debate where, you know, the chairman of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, was a former industry lobbyist, former head of the lobbying organization for the telecom industry. And what he put forth last year was a, you know, a pro-industry piece of rulemaking that would allow a tiered internet, allow the internet to really kind of be turned into like cable TV where you'd have to buy packages based on what you could afford, and that would determine what content you could see and you know, what speeds you have. And so we were told at that time that, you know, fighting for real net neutrality where the internet is considered to be like a public utility that everybody should have equal access to it. You know, electricity comes to your home. It doesn't depend on how many, you know, things you plug in. Everybody gets electricity. The internet needs to come to our home. We need to have full access to what's on the internet. So we were told that was politically not doable. It was off the table. And we were part of a great coalition, a very diverse coalition that worked together. And we used a combination of online activism, lawyers who were meeting inside the FCC with the staff there who really understand the rules, as well as activists on the outside who are applying pressure as necessary. And working together, we succeeded in not only getting what we wanted onto the table, but then throughout the year, as the FCC tried to kind of, you know, we would fight back and they would say that, you know, that's not enough, or they would put forth inadequate proposals, we held firm on what we wanted. And in the end, we won. And so just February 26th, they voted for reclassifying the internet as a common carrier, and that gives us the rules that we need to hopefully enforce real net neutrality.
Okay, yeah, some have compared what the corporate interests want to do is basically set up a toll road on the internet. You know, and also, restrict content. I mean, you could just imagine, I mean, what kind of, censorship would be involved if they would have total control over that. I mean, we see what goes on with the corporate media, so this would just be another extension of that. So, wow, this is, it's nice to have a victory, now and then, you know, it helps keep you going and stuff. So now, you know, we turn now to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is going to be a big battle coming up here. And maybe you could just start off by letting the listeners know why this is so important to fight back on this.
Sure, thank you. And I would say this is a battle that we're in the heat of right now. Mm-hmm. So, and really what it boils down to is even beyond the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that the president is asking Congress to give him something called Fast Track Trade Promotion Authority, which would allow for the next 7 years, whoever is president would have the authority to negotiate agreements in secret and sign them before they go to Congress. And when they go to Congress, they would have a very restricted amount of time to look at what's in that agreement, to hold hearings on it. They would have no amendments and then just be allowed to vote up or down on it. And so this really subverts democracy, prevents transparency, prevents us from knowing what's in these agreements and what impact they'll have. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the one that's coming up, you know, the fastest. It's an agreement that's between 12 different countries, Pacific Rim countries, and it really has 29 chapters, but only 4 or 5 of them are about trade. So this is about much more than a trade agreement. It's really enhancing global corporate power and undermining our ability to protect our communities and protect the planet. And so this is really a game changer, and the president is asking Congress to give him fast track so he can sign a TPP. But there are other agreements that are coming down the line. There's a European version. There's a financial agreement that would really deregulate finance and put our economies around the world at risk. So We really need to stop this fast-track legislation. That's the real key thing.
Yeah, now what this specifically does, it'll be able to override local, state, and national laws, like, for instance, food and safety laws, labor laws, and then potentially could even prevent from a single-payer Medicare-for-all system ever being enacted in the United States. Is this correct?
That's all correct. I mean, think about things like wanting to know what's in your food. You know, food labeling would be considered a barrier, a trade barrier, because it's a barrier to profit. You know, if we know what's in our food, if it's nasty, we may not buy it. So these are things that really hurt us, allowing, you know, industries to come into our communities and pollute. So it really undermines our ability to control, to protect our communities.
Now, this is not unprecedented. I mean, after NAFTA was passed, I believe there were several corporate, successful corporate challenges like, for instance, local laws against herbicide spraying and other things that were causing real health hazards to people in the community. Is that correct?
That's right. And there's an ongoing case right now where a corporation is suing Canada because they banned fracking in the St. Lawrence River area, and that company wants to frack there. So, you know, it's been going on for the last 20 years. It's ongoing, and this would actually enhance their ability to determine and to sue us. But they could sue us not just for the amount of money they've invested in, you know, trying to do whatever it is they're doing, but for their expected loss of profit.
Oh, so wow.
You can see these would be billion-dollar cases against communities that we wouldn't be able to afford.
Well, I mean, you talk about a threat to the democracy and the will of the people and safety, health and safety standards, you know. I mean, this is just, you know, it's mind-boggling. I mean, it's almost like some kind of, you know, science fiction horror, you know, film, but it's our reality at this point. And, you know, about, you know, corporate control. And this total unbridled, unregulated corporate control is literally destroying our standard of living, destroying the world. I mean, I don't think that's too much of an understatement, you know, and this is what's real important about the Trans-Pacific. Now, what about its sister companion, the Transatlantic Partnership? I heard something about that's been kind of stalled and delayed by European activists at this point.
Well, there's been some really fantastic activism going on in Europe. They had like a global day of action where they had like 1,500 actions. I wish we could do that here, but we've had some success even with the resistance that we have. But they've been pushing really hard against this. It's called investor-state dispute settlement, giving corporations the right to sue us over our laws if they interfere with profits. They've really been fighting for transparency to be able to see what's in the agreement. The U.S. has been fighting back against that, but Europe has agreed to allow people to see what their negotiating positions are. They can't let them see the whole text. Mm-hmm. And there was a recent leak in the U.K. of some of the text, and it showed that what the public had been told about the impacts of TTIP on the National Health Service, that they were told that it wouldn't affect it, that it wasn't part of the deal. They found out through these leaks that actually the National Health Service is under attack and is part of the agreement. And so, you know, we can't really believe what we're being told. It's really imperative that we, as the public, see what's in this agreement and understand the impact of it on us before we allow it to go into law, because it's a game changer and it will be very hard to undo.
Okay. Well, then I think, you know, we need to mobilize as many people. In the last few minutes we have left here, where do you recommend people go to as far as on the internet to find out more information about organizing?
Of course, this is a huge fight for us at Popular Resistance. So if you go to popularresistance.org, you can see up in the slider there's a posting, and I think it's called National Organizing to Stop Fast Track. And we have next week members of Congress from the House side will be at home in their districts. So people are doing actions at home to talk to their legislators and pressure them to not support Fast Track, to oppose Fast Track. We're also organizing weekly calls that you can register for, to inform you on what's going on and help you with organizing actions in your community. And then on March 19th, we have a big action in Congress that we're asking people to come and help support. It's a no-risk arrest action that I think will be very powerful, and so people can sign up if they're able to make it to D.C. for that. They will also have a new tool that will be up shortly called StopFastTrack.com, which will help people to send emails and and phone in to their legislators. So if you go to popularresistance.org, you'll find all of this information.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to call in and letting our listeners know, some of the details of these, battles that are going on that is going to affect them eventually one way or another, and also letting them know what they can do about it and where they can go. So thank you again so much, and you hang in there, and we're here rooting for you and others
thank
like you.
You.
Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
We are the dogs of Tijuana, filled with garbage and stones, in the streets and in the fields, cursed and crushed beneath the wheels, but together we are strong. Our songs echo in the darkness, down the Maquiladora's halls, where Brother Solomon was tortured, and one tree in the orchard cast a shadow on the wall. Is hard and long, but the dogs are coming home. We are the dogs of Tijuana, left for dead in the ravine, in the arroyos and the valleys, the sewers and the alleys. We shiver and we dream, so don't stop to ask directions. If you think you lost your way, the wrath of the lion is the wisdom of God, and every dog has its day.
Okay, we're back. That was Tom Morello, Dogs of Tijuana. And we had a caller call in to say that I was mistaken. It was a public citizen that
in Springfield
that came out and testified in support of the Illinois single payer bill. I said, I think public action or something. Yeah, interesting story about Public Citizen. It's a nationwide organization. It's been around for a good 30 years or so. Well, they've always been single payer supporters until about a few years ago, right before Obamacare bill was being introduced and everything. Hillary Clinton herself went to their national convention, which basically when she had a room full of the main staffers and heads of the national organization, she basically threatened them that if you continue to support single payer, we're going to make sure that not only are you going to lose government funding for your organization, but we're going to make sure all your corporate and foundation, foundation funding is going to be cut off. So they backed off for a while, but evidently now they've come back on board. So great to them.
Yeah. You know?
Good. But this is what you're going to have. I'm telling you, people, first of all, Obamacare is not the solution. It's basically, and I argue with some of my liberal Democratic friends this to this day, despite the evidence that's been presented, is that Obamacare was not meant to help people with their insurance needs.
Insurance companies.
Exactly. And it was meant to distract us because the majority of the American people want Medicare single payer for all. It varies anywhere from 65 to 80%, depending on how you ask the poll question. Basically, they know the people want it, and they had to do something because the momentum was building back in 2006, 2007, especially Obama getting elected in 2008. Hope and change, remember? Hope and change. So anyway, they had to do something, and they came up with this republic. This bill was basically conceived in the Brookings Institute, which is a right-wing conservative Republican think tank back in the 1980s. Republican Governor Mitt Romney introduced this bill.
Could be called Romneycare.
Right, in Massachusetts, and it's amazing here. And liberal Democrats try to defend a Republican produced conceived healthcare bill and a Republican introduced bill in a state that was Republican governor, and it's the very same bill that basically the Obama and the Democratic Party pushed on Congress. And again, just a little background: is when they had the public hearings on this, they refused to allow anybody testify about single payer. In fact, Dr. Margaret Flowers was at that committee hearing chaired by Democratic Senator Max Baucus, and she was one of over 112 healthcare activists that was arrested the last day of the hearing when they began just to stand up and speak out about single payer. So listen, people, you've got to know the history here. And who wrote this bill? A woman named Liz Fowler was the main author of this bill that kind of fine-tuned it. And she is a healthcare industry lobbyist. She briefly was in the Obama administration, and then she left and went back into the private sector. I think she was working for a pharmaceutical company now. So, you know, you got to know your facts, and you got to know why they did this. They did this to subsidize the private insurance industry and to distract and prevent from single-payer Medicare from all from being enacted. They wanted to take the wind out of the sails of the meat of the movement, and they wanted to basically make people, a majority of people, think that this is solving our healthcare problem, and it's not. And nothing is going to solve our healthcare problem except for Medicare single payer for all. This has been a proven fact in, you know, every industrialized world country in the world, even some third world countries, and the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't have a public healthcare system is the United States. So I just want to be clear on that. I'm glad about Public Citizen. That's they've always been a great organization, and they backed off for a while, but they're right back in the fray. So that's really good. So anyway,
we got a little note here from somebody saying that one of the conservative think tanks was the Heritage Foundation.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much. That was the Heritage Foundation. Yes, it was. Yeah. It wasn't the Brookings Institute.
But they all think alike, you know.
Yeah. You know. And so anyway, yeah, it's going to be interesting. And, you know, this Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement that's coming down, I mean, you know, this is very important. When we get anybody out there, I mean, you get any kind of emails or you go to popularresistance.org and find out more information, because we need to definitely try to stop this, because it's going to, you know, we're suffering enough, and if they get this through, I mean, it's going to be our work's going to be even more difficult to try to crawl back out of the huge corporate pit that's been dug for us in these last few decades and stuff. And some interesting things are going around the world, though. I mean, you know, in Greece, the Syriza party was elected, and it looks like you know, people are definitely really happy there. It's not going to be an easy road for the new government.
There's still a tug of war going on with Germany and.
Well, they try to make it sound like it's Germany, EU, but it's basically, you know, the EU, and it's basically, right, specifically, it's the bank and financial interests of these countries, not the people of these countries,
right,
you know.
Exactly. Same thing that happens here. You
exactly.
Know, the corporate interests.
Yes. You know? And, it looks like there's going to be elections coming up in Spain, and it looks like the Podemos party in Spain is very similar to the Syriza party in Greece is posed to possibly win that election. A little close to home, we got the Chicago City Council and Alderman and mayoral election.
Yeah.
Coming up here, that's going to be here in less than, well, about 2 weeks, April 7th, 3 weeks, and people are fighting back, and more people got to get on board, because there's been a lot of people out there fighting for a long time, been doing the heavy lifting, and you know, it's amazing what they've been able to do. But until more people get on board and get involved to whatever degree you can, whatever time you have, every little bit's going to help, and everybody can do something. You know,
Mayor 1% is being threatened up there in Chicago.
Oh, indeed, indeed, yeah. Indeed. In fact, he had a recent campaign commercial in which he's sitting at his his kitchen table, and he's in a sweater, and he's got a cup of coffee, and he's talking about, I've made some mistakes, and I do rub people the wrong way sometimes, but I've done all this for the common good. I'm just trying to do what's right, and it's like, oh, what a bunch of baloney. But it's interesting he's taking that approach all of a sudden. Obviously, his political consultants realize that he's got a public image problem.
Yes, he does.
Yeah. So, I mean, this guy, I mean, you know, before he got involved, well, before he was elected a congressman and before he got part of the Obama administration and came back and got elected mayor of Chicago, his main job in the Democratic National Committee up in the Chicago area is to try to prevent people getting elected in the Democratic primaries who were populist or progressives. That was his, and he was pretty effective with it. I mean, and they would even go so far as even they knew by defeating a certain progressive or populist candidate in the Democratic primary, even when they knew that by defeating that candidate and the candidate they supported was probably going to get beaten by the Republican, they still did it. You know, because you got to understand the corporate interests, you know, they donate money to both political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. Sometimes they'll even donate money to two different candidates running in the same race against each other.
Right.
You know, they don't care. I mean, and there's a lot of people out there, politicians that really are Republicans, but know they can't get elected Republicans, so they run as a Democrat. So don't let these labels fool you, people. Don't think for a minute that the Democratic Party is the champion of the working people, because, you know, it all depends. It's all about who the person is. We locally here with Carol Ammons, she's been a community activist for a long time, and we knew her, and we knew that, you know, and, you know, the thing is, whether it's someone like Carol, I mean, you know, the one thing they got to decide on, making a tactical decision, if they want to run as a third party candidate or do they want to run as a Democrat. And a lot of times you just can't get, at this point in time anyway, you can't get elected any other way than to run, you know, in the Democratic Party. I'd like to see some Lincoln Republicans run in the Republican primaries,
right,
frankly. Some people that basically want to bring back the true Republican Party's, values, if you will, you know, those of Lincoln, who said that labor always precedes capital, and even made an appointment that, some statement of the effect that, you know, the people have the right to change their government, any means necessary, more or less, you know. I mean, and even Teddy Roosevelt, even though I had some issues with him historically, he still was good on a lot of things with antitrust acts, also setting up the national park system and conservation, you know. So, and Eisenhower, Dwight D. Eisenhower, general, I mean, my dad did not like Eisenhower. He thought he was a really conservative, anti-union person. But man, you look at what Eisenhower's policies were and what he said back in the late, you know, right before he left office in 1960.
The famous statement about the military-industrial complex.
If Eisenhower was alive today, he would be in the left wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, that's just how far we've sunk in people, and we've got to push back and we got to push forward, because my God, we're in the 21st century and we're going back to the 19th century here, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox now. Bob, do you have any last words for our listeners today?
Well, wanted to mention a little bit about that NLRB vote. The Senate voted Wednesday to overturn a federal regulation that Republicans say will put companies at an unfair disadvantage when their employees decide to hold a union election. So in December, the NLRB issued a rule that shortens the time between when union organizers ask for a union election at a company and when that company must allow the election to take place. The rule could force companies to allow these elections to happen as soon as 11 days after they're notified, which Republicans say doesn't give companies enough time to react. You know, Republican opponents of the